more definite language than what I have just done. It needs, of course, some pondering on. Always try and leaven what you study, what you browse over, brood upon. Always try and leaven it with the beauty of things like poetry and myths and legends, because that is Kundalini. That will help your Kundalini rise safely, successfully. Robert Browning was fascinated with the life of Paracelsus, who seemed to be able to produce extraordinary results of creativity, creating a whole new medicine almost on his own. Was fascinated by the extraordinary powers and how Paracelsus proclaimed always that it was not he, it was the god, the fire god within him that was doing it. And this lovely poem, I'm going to break it as I go along, is from Robert Browning's Paracelsus. Thus God, fire if you like, God dwells in all, from life's minute beginnings up at last to man, the consummation of this scheme of being, the completion of this sphere of life, whose attributes had here and there been scattered over the visible world before, asking to be combined, dim fragments meant to be united into some wondrous whole, imperfect qualities throughout creation, suggesting some one creature yet to make, some point where all these scattered rays should meet, convergent in the faculties of man. Beautiful summation by a Westerner, mark you, of this process of these fires trying to help man to be eligible for the highest emissions of Kundalini, as I have just described, Robert Browning's Paracelsus. And then he talks about, of course, the hope that Kundalini might spread itself throughout the whole globe, and that all mankind may be filled with this creative power and a new type of Superman come into being, which is exactly what we talk about in esoteric science. When I go around the world and people say, I meet old cobbers from the war, people who haven't seen me for 20, 30 years, yeah, what's it all about? And I say, it's quite simple. I believe in immortality. That's why I'm here. I'm trying to convince people that they are immortal and that they can be aware of their immortality and have the fruits of knowing that you are immortal. Well, Browning, of course, had this tremendous capacity as he was nearing perfection himself to describe what man would be like. So in man's self arises august anticipations, symbols, types of a dim splendor ever on before in that eternal circle of life. For men begin to pass their nature's bounds, and they find new hopes and cares which fast supplant their proper joys and griefs. They outgrow all the narrow creeds of right and wrong, which fade before the unmeasured thirst for good, while peace rises within them ever more and more. Such men are even now upon the earth, serene amid the half-formed creatures round. That particular piece of Paracelsus has, of course, stirred many of us in our own ashramic group. So what is the aim of it all? We can only describe that aim in terms of our own civilization, our own culture here and now, today, in the West. And the easiest way to describe it is that there are natural forces, as Browning said, natural forces trying to draw all the bits and pieces of our nature together, to refashion it and draw them better together in an ultimate synthesis. And we call that, of course, by the words of my old mentor, who was Robert Assagioli, in psychosynthesis. And psychosynthesis lacked one thing, something that could not be explained. You know what psychosynthesis is? It's the taking of the elements of our personality and trying to build them around higher and higher points of consciousness. Here is a personality possibly like the first you began to manifest in this life or from previous lives. And the matter of psychosynthesis means that you must pitch your consciousness to a higher point and then break up the old personality. A dangerous thing, the psychiatrists would say. I say nonsense. And to drop out some of these parts of the personality, the habits, the attitudes of old, and to reassemble all around this higher point of consciousness. And still higher, and still higher, so that eventually we have a personality that is regular, stable, creative, ready for divine from the higher self, there's the higher self, divine or higher self intervention. And we say here now that this process of releasing planetary kundalini can assist. It is immense target, of course, that we are reaching for. Today we talk about meditation. Meditation is the safest, surest way of lifting that point of consciousness higher and higher. But meditation can often turn people who are dry into being wet, can often produce very soppy personalities, personalities that are incapable, nice people who nevertheless are very frail and can't do anything with their personality. And there is something missing in it all, and it is my contention here that we rightly give a lot of attention to the subject of meditation, but we should also be consolidating the personality for psychosynthesis so that meditation can be more effective. And I believe that it's through this device. How do we do it? We do it through opening chakras in the head region. We do it through opening chakras in the head region, and I have treated this subject, as you well know, ad nauseam. The necessity to bring energy, more and more energy, into the upper part of the body, so that the Ajna center between the eyebrows can be charged, the thousand-petaled lotus on the crown of the head can be charged, and another chakra here, said to have wings to it, the Alta Major can be charged, and the three together produce an interaction with each other that builds a capstone to the pyramid of man. Builds a capstone, and if you like, the symbol of the third eye in the capstone. The rest of the pyramid of man, of course, from the neck downwards, is not so much concern to us. The opening of the third eye is a natural phenomenon associated with kundalini. And the whole process is assisted in various ways. One of the ways in which you can assist this is through the attitude. In astrology, we give a whole house to the subject of a person's attitudes. And we give that house, the house that we give to attitudes is the first house, the most important in astrology. The first house is also the home of the soul, the higher nature. And so we say that by changing attitudes, and kundalini helps in this, by changing attitudes, we are able to produce phenomena in the capstone of man, the region of the third eye. And one of the ways, simple ways, is to inject joy into the life, to inject joy. We always say that the monk is so right in his monastery, where he learns to love what he's doing and learns to love who he is with and where he is. And this love produces joy. And as W.B. Yeats, the Irish mystic poet, says, joy is wisdom. Joy is wisdom. And by manifesting joy in the life, you are drawing in the energies of buddhi. And the energies of buddhi, of course, are focused on the heart chakra. And the heart chakra is one of those stations up the spine that the kundalini must reach on its way to the thousand-petaled lotus, which I have drawn in there, on the vertex of the head. So we say that changes of attitude, now you don't have to buy anything for that. You can change your attitude very easily. You can start tomorrow with it. You're lucky you haven't got to go to the opposite extreme where you need to damp down some of the over-enthusiasm of people on the path whose own enthusiasm can hide, mask, depress the reality of what they are doing. The West had no evidence of kundalini and still has no evidence of it, except through the kind of things that I'm telling you about here tonight. People who manifest a joy in their lives, in what they're doing. Call it enthusiasm if you like, but you must be careful with the word enthusios. Alice Bailey wasn't very happy with people who were a bit too enthusiastic. She found that they could be very disruptive in her particular group work. So the cultivation of joy, and that is one of the little things that I have to say about kundalini. But where is the evidence? This was brought to a stage further by a Dr. Buck, who had an experience of cosmic consciousness. He had what I have experienced since a child, an inflow of a tremendous force that manifested in him in such a way that he said it lit up everything around him. He was a man of superb scientific background. In 1876, Richard Buck, MD, superintendent of a provincial asylum for the insane in Hamilton, Ontario, became professor of mental and nervous diseases at Western University, then president of the psychological section of the British Medical Association, and in 1890 president of the American Medico-Psychological, and so on and so on and so on. He was an incredibly accomplished academic. He said this. He said he and two friends had spent the evening reading Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, and Browning, and especially, he said, Walt Whitman. They parted at midnight, and he had a long drive in a hansom cab, and his mind was deeply under the influence of the ideas and images and emotions called up by the reading and talk of the evening. He was calm and peaceful when he arrived home. There, this experience happened. All at once, without warning of any kind, he found himself wrapped around, as it were, by a flame-colored cloud. For an instant, he thought of fire, some sudden conflagration in the great city, perhaps. The next instant, he knew that the light was within himself. Directly after, there came upon him a sense of exaltation, of immense joyousness, accompanied or immediately followed by an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Into his brain streamed one momentary lightning flash of the Brahmanic splendor, which ever since lightened his life. Upon his heart fell one drop of Brahma bliss, he said, leaving thenceforward for always an aftertaste of heaven. And goes on. Now, Buck's experience was instantaneous, but it transformed him permanently for the rest of his life. He did what I did. I looked around me after my fire experiences and said, I can't talk about these, unless there are others that have had the experience, and I searched desperately to find who they were. Dr. Buck did the same. He looked around and he, in his book, quotes many examples of those who he believed had the same kind of experience. Some of them we know well. He talks of Moses. Moses and the burning bush from which God spoke to him. Here was this bush shaped like an aura, and it was all fire, with fire coming out of it, and from the midst of the bush there came words, words that he believed were from God himself, and they told him what to do with his tribe of Israel. And the fire, he said, of the bush reflected onto his face and onto his body with such intensity that when he came down from the mountain, he was still glowing from it all, and people remarked at it. Then there was Isaiah. He had a vision of God. Let me read it to you. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the whole temple. Above him stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face. With twain he covered his feet. With twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the threshold were moved at the voice of him that cried, and the houses were filled with smoke. Then said I, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphims into me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from off the altar, and he touched my mouth with it, and said, Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin is purged. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? Then I said, Here am I. Send me. The other names I will read to you later. We're going to have a break now. Dr. Buck, his book, Cosmic Consciousness. He said what he believed was signs of this experience are in the lives of St. Paul, of Mahomet, of Dante Alighieri, of Francis Bacon, William Blake, Jacob Boehmer, Balzac, Roger Bacon, Spinoza, Tennyson, Thoreau, and several MDs that he knew personally. He also talked about a man called Pascal, Blaise Pascal, extraordinary person. He was a scientist, brilliant mathematician. He had made his name in French literature, and the same thing happened to him as happened to Swedenborg. In the midst of his work, orthodox work, which had brought him some fame, he stopped it all. Something had happened to him. And what had happened was he had a fire experience, completely unanticipated, and it changed the way he looked at everything. Let me see if I can find it here. Pascal was also a scientist of note, yet never placed reason above his deepest spiritual convictions. His experiences during a state of withdrawal from the world included the phenomenon of fire. In growth towards rapid spiritual illumination, very, very rarely a savant, who usually identifies himself with a Christ force, experiences traumatizing and elevated incursions of spiritual fire, which acts as an alchemizing agent on the alchemist himself. A surprised Pascal experienced fire only a few times. It served to impress him that the way of the soul was the only way. He recorded fire experiences in his spiritual diary, and when he died it was found that he had clutched a page concerning a fire experience that he had written about and had placed it close to his heart. It was found on him when they discovered he was dead. He made it clear that despite his capture of both the scientific and literary world, he still preferred what his soul had to offer. Then there are those who believe that immortality can be achieved in some degree through procreation and the living on one's own genes and chromosomes in a species. Let me now read to you his experience. Translated into the English. It happened in 1654 on Monday the 23rd of November, the day of St. Clement, Pope and Martyr. From about 10:30 in the evening until about 12:30 midnight, fire. God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of the philosophers nor of the wise, assurance, joy, assurance, feeling, joy, peace, God of Jesus Christ, my God and thy God. Thy God shall be my God, forgotten of the world and of all except God. He is only found in the ways taught in the gospel, the sublimity of the human soul. Just Father, the world has not known thee, but I have known thee now. Joy, 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 tears of joy. I do not separate myself from thee. They left me behind, me, a fountain of living water. My God, do not leave me. Let me not be separated from thee eternally. This is eternal life, that they should know thee, the only true God, and him whom thou hast sent. Jesus Christ, I have separated myself from him. I have fled, renounced, crucified him. Let me not be forever separated from him. One is saved only by the teaching of the gospel, reconciliation, total and sweet, total submission to the Christ and to my director. An outpouring of a person who, for 2 hours in his life, was confronted with fire, not just confronted, but it passing through him and giving him extraordinary ecstasy and joy, as well as the sensation of light. Pascal, a scientist, a mathematician, extraordinary experience. In my opinion, one of the ways in which Maya can be encouraged, and it's not a very romantic way, can be encouraged is to discover for yourselves, or to be taught it, of course, that the world that we live in is not what it appears to be. I have taught this subject many times, and I don't want to press on with it to bore you. But to understand that this tangible world, this structure that we live in amongst, that the material of it is not permanent. It is transient. And although when we touch it, we say it feels so solid, and it is smooth, and it is shiny, and it is cool. All these things are coming to us through our senses. But the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, that matter is not solid. And the rationale of that statement is based on scientific observation. When you run your finger along a smooth walnut surface of a table, it tells you all those things. Soft, smooth, whatever. But the truth is, when you start to look into the nature of the wood and the molecules that make up the nature of that wood, the molecules are bouncing around against each other. And it varies according to the temperature of the object. So here you are. Here you are with your finger. It is there. Not a bad finger, really. You're running it along the surface of some object. And you think that it is smooth, solid, it will live forever, it's a wonderful structure to possess, it's mine, and people admire it. But when you come to look into it, of course, we know that the molecules of wood are darting around, bouncing against each other. And when you take one of the molecules, you find that it's made up of many atoms making up a molecule. And when you take one of the atoms and look at it, what do you find? If I expanded the atom to the size of this lecture room, if I expanded the atom to the size of the lecture room, you would find that the material in it, which is tangible, the material in it which is tangible, is incredibly tiny. The whole space could be a town hall of space, depending on the nature of the atom. In that whole town hall of space, the nucleus of that atom might not be any bigger than that. And the electrons which move around it, no bigger than that. And the rest of the atom is empty. The rest of the atom is empty. This is the solid structure, the material form that people build up their lives on. And if you go and take the nucleus of the atom and you expand that immensely, perhaps the same size again, you find that the nucleus is empty, that there are a few electrical charges moving around. The atom is, the nucleus of the atom is just as empty as the atom itself. Now that's scientific fact. There's no argument about it. It is our senses, the sense of touch, that conveys to our computer brain certain information. The sense of touch and taste and smell and sight and hearing. These are the five senses that convey knowledge of the material world, and the knowledge that they convey doesn't say, hey, you're in touch with an object that is very empty, that is changing the whole, the information is almost the string of lies, as it were. And what is more, when whatever you're looking at penetrates to the back of the eye, where chemical changes are affected by the input of light, the information that is carried to the brain, actually to the occipital lobe of the brain, the information is just in terms of oscillations, energy waves, if you like, whatever you like to call it, electrical information. You don't see the table. You don't touch the table. What you are doing is using the senses to apprehend it. And the senses convey, through the various lines of force that I've suggested here, impressions to the brain. And the brain decides, as a computer, what it is in touch with. And that's what people are enamored with, the material world. Not just one car, two cars, one for the wife because she's got to take the kids to school. Not one house, two houses, one in the country. And so on and so on and so on. And in some parts of the world, this is an obsession. And of course we think immediately of Hollywood. An obsession with form and the romantic spectacle of it. And it takes people's attention completely in life. And if your attention is taken completely in life by something else, then to look into the world of the esoteric, where permanence exists forever, where your higher self is immortal, this you can't apprehend because all your attention is going out to form. And the inner worlds are ignored. The ancients knew this and they called it Maya. Maya, illusion, the grand illusion of the world that people think is so real and is going to last forever, when it could be taken away from you tomorrow morning in an accident, or next week or next year, but it will be taken away from you sooner or later. And if you are strongly attached to any form, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt and produce pain. And pain comes from being attached to some thought, word, deed, person, whatever you can imagine. And so, that is Maya. The Hindus described her as a whore who is dancing and making all kinds of attractive movements, so that the person who is confronted with a material object is dazzled by it, wants it, is attached to it. It's mine. I not only own it, it's part of me. A bridge in my teeth. I don't even know which tooth it is. I have accepted it as mine. I can't distinguish between it and one of my own teeth. The world is hoodwinked in that way. And I believe that the quickest way, one of the quickest ways, and there are others, of course, we've talked about change in attitude, but one of the quickest ways of encouraging the kundalini advancement in consciousness, spiritual consciousness, is to understand this factor about Maya. It is an illusion. Treat it for what it is. Use it by all means. There's no reason why you shouldn't be rich and own things. But for heaven's sake, don't be attached to them. Don't believe that they are reality, because they are not. Reality lies with the immortal part of you that may not go on existing on this planet, but somewhere it will go on existing for all time. Now that's a very precious thing to have. So Maya, one of the great laughs at the way in which the world functions was through the writings of Erasmus. Erasmus was able to take the simple Maya that I have described here of objects that dazzle, Hollywood films that dazzle and entrap and ensnare people, into this belief that material form is everything. And America's been dragged with it into terminal materialism. That's the end. They will get involved more and more with it, and there's got to be an end to it, because it has no reality and it has no immortality. So understanding Maya is helpful. And Erasmus took Maya. He had a revelation. He was on horseback. Not easy for a man of his age, and he was comparatively young at the time, but still in those days considered old. He was on horseback crossing Europe from Rome to England. He was coming to England to see Thomas More. And while he was on horseback going along day after day after day, he formulated an essay on what he called the praise of folly, the praise of folly. And in fact, he was describing Maya, but the psychological basis of Maya, how Maya comes across to somebody who can see it objectively as being just a trimming of this particular planet and not in any way related to immortality or eternity. And so he wrote this essay for his friend Thomas More, and in it he describes human character, the different guises that human character takes on. For example, in marriage, mankind believes that it must marry to perpetuate the species. Then he pokes into it and says, what man would marry if he really knew the inconveniences of it? What woman would ever give herself to a man if she took account of the perilous pangs of childbirth and the trouble of bringing up children? Or having done so once, would ever think of doing so again, unless attended by Leti, the goddess of forgetfulness? And with astute irony, Erasmus shows how we become the personas we hide behind when we avoid harsh reality, preferring the bliss of ignorance. And he has a go at all kinds of people. He said, all men are actors, deceived by their own masks, thinking themselves to be the very characters that they impersonate. Shall we then pluck off the masks? Nay, rather let men play their parts, and happier perchance are we too if we perceive their masks. Illusion is the balm of life, and a worse calamity than to be deceived is not to be deceived. If a man sincerely thinks his commonplace wife is a Penelope, meaning that she is very beautiful, all the better for their married bliss. Happy are they who sit in Plato's cave, viewing the shadows, than those who come out into the light and see things as they really are. Now he hits at scientists and actors and scholars. The ignorance of the simple is a boon. How blessed were those pristine men of the Golden Age who lived in accordance with nature, knowing nothing of grammar, of rhetoric, or law, not bothering their heads as to what lay beyond the sky. How happy flies and birds. But now look at men, such morons. They play, they sing and laugh and bring others pleasure with their childishness. Compare the moron with a scholar who squanders his youth in mastering the disciplines, wastes the sweetness of his years in worry and sweat and vigils, always frugal, poor, lugubrious, gloomy, unjust, and harsh to himself, grating and grieving to others, lean, flail, bleary-eyed, old before his time. And so he goes on pouring scorn on the way humanity is deluded by the persona that they adopt. He equates butchers with huntsmen. The foolishness of those who leave slaughtering to the lower classes, but consider carving up a beast felled in the hunt to be fit work for a gentleman. The foolishness of inordinate builders, of gamblers, of those who call upon the saints to cure their toothache, of the thief who, saved from the gallows by the intervention of a saint, feels himself commissioned to relieve men again of their wealth. The foolishness of those who mock him, who tells them that the way to die is those who mock him, who tells them that the way to die well is to live well. Sorry about that. Then he attacks monks and churchmen like yourself. No morons so play the fool as those who are obsessed with the ardor of Christian piety to the point that they distribute their goods, overlook injuries, suffer themselves to be deceived, make no distinction between friends and enemies, eschew pleasure, glut themselves with hunger, vigils, tears, toils, and reproaches, who disdain life, who crave only death, who seem utterly to condemn all common sense, as if the soul lived elsewhere and not in the body. What is this if it is not insanity? Then he attacks his own profession. With what tumults everywhere our lives are filled. We do business, we sail the seas, we engage in wars, we make treaties and we break them. We beget children, enroll heirs, buy fields and sell, cement friendships, erect buildings and tear them down. We are tonsured, anointed, invested in cowls. We are exercised in various arts, sweat, and become doctors or laws of theology. Some prefer the mitre and the quassier. With such cares we torture ourselves. In this we wax old, in this we let slip so many years and lose that precious treasure which alone is of worth. Then will come the last tribunal, where only truth can stand. Too late, we shall discover that all these vanities were but shadows, and we have squandered our lives in the delusion of a dream. Someone will say, shall a Christian then have nothing to do with all of these vanities? No, not that. But we shall participate only with detachment. We will participate only with detachment. Being ready to forsake all for the sake of the one needful thing, as Paul said. Having a wife, as if not having. Weeping, as if not weeping. Rejoicing, as if not rejoicing. Selling as possessing nothing, using the world as if not using, for the fashion of this world passes away. Use then the world, but delight not from it. Madame Blavatsky said of the same line of thought, she said, kill out ambition, but live like one ambitious. I had to do that myself, and it was very, very hard. To retain your enthusiasm and your ambition to serve mankind, to study the classics, to meditate each day. Kill out your ambitions, but live like one ambitious. Don't throw away your enthusiasm because you realize now that Maya is an illusion, that this world is an illusion, that we put on bodies and personalities and hats and shapes and talk in different ways. All that is illusion. If we have faith in it, we've been fooled. What is not illusion is the inner worlds and the nature of the soul. So my words there then point to the necessity not to be carried along, rolled around in earth's diurnal frame, believing that this world is the reality. The world, this world even, is not the most developed in the universe. There are other planets elsewhere. Our world, technically,